Hey, it's Adam Grant from Work Life, a podcast from TED. This episode is brought to you by Freshworks. Freshworks believes that complexity is the enemy of efficiency. So stop wrestling with bloated, expensive service software that takes forever to implement an update, where ROI is someday, not today. You've been overcharged and underserved for way too long. Uncomplicate with Freshservice for IT and Freshdesk for customer support. And with Freshworks AI-assisted service software, you'll work smarter, not harder. Freshworks uncomplicates. Learn more at freshworks.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Are you not entertained? No, we're not really. A weekend of 1-0 wins and 1-1 draws is best summed up by Manchester United v Arsenal being dominated by controversy of a defensive wall being a whole 1.2 yards further away than it should have been. Whatever will this season throw at us next? Thank God for Tottenham and Bournemouth providing some madness and lovely goals, but we'll also discuss Nottingham Forest, Erling Haaland, Aston Villa and loads more on what will be a very entertaining game podcast. I'm Tom Clark and joining me today we have the senior sports writer and Sunday Times columnist Alison Rudd, the reporter and European football expert Tom Allnutt and the former defender turned footballer Gregor Robertson is here as usual. Here we are then.
Former footballer turned footballer.
Former footballer turned footballer. Oh yeah, good point.
I'm making a return.
He's back. He's back.
Watching some of the draws this weekend, though, I thought, you never know.
You can do it. You can do it. See, we're having a laugh already. The three great entertainers are here. But yes, thank you for that, Alison. Good spot. But yeah, I'm excited for your career relaunch now. That's great. I believe in you. Anyway, as so often on a Monday this season, we head to Tottenham. And two of the great entertainers this season, Tom Allnutt, you were there. Great fun, wasn't it? You must say yes.
Yeah, I came into this room and I was sort of asked how the game was, and I said, and I felt like I was being bullied by three people here telling me the game must be entertaining. You must say it was fantastic.
Well, only because I'd written that entire intro premise that we were going to come to you at a 2-2 draw. Yeah. And if you said it was crap, then we really were in trouble.
This is interesting because we're being quite evangelistic about it. If you were there, was it different?
No.
On telly, it was fantastic.
It was right great. Why did you do a northern accent then?
No idea.
Where did you?
Yeah. Anyway, back to the football.
It was a good game. It was a good game. I think there was a good mix between, you know, one of the best pressing teams in the league, Bournemouth, against Tottenham, who, you know, are one of the most calamitous teams when it comes to playing out from the back at the moment. So you had a match that was, I mean, Ange Postecoglou said after the match it was like a basketball match, and it was like that. It was end-to-end chances for both teams. I mean, I think Bournemouth will feel like they've missed a huge opportunity to win the game. They were 2-0 up, probably could have been 2 or 3 up after, you know, 10 minutes. And the win was there for them. You know, Spurs were playing pretty terribly, I think, for the majority of the first half. The first couple of minutes was, I mean, I struggled to remember a worse opening 2 or 3 minutes, even the worst sort of opening 20 seconds. You know,
there's that intro out the window now, for God's sake.
Romero's, you know, gave the ball away after 18 seconds and gave it straight to Evan Nilsson, who should have scored. And it was a bit like that for the first kind of 10, 15 minutes from Spurs.
I did think it said, though, everything about Tottenham, though, the nature of Romero's apology was the most casual thing, just a little hand up. Like, you'd literally nearly given him a go. Oh, sorry, lads. It was a shocking error. Shocking. There was no head in the hands. Gregor's like, game's gone. No, never in my day. Would have been docked 3 weeks wedges for that one, wouldn't you?
I mean, it's not that unusual, I don't think, for Spurs to kind of have the ball on the edge of their area and give it to the opposition striker. That's, you know, that tends to happen quite a lot. They got better. Tottenham got sort of better in the second half. Bournemouth didn't put them away. And, you know, two goals that I guess came sort of a bit out of nowhere for Spurs. The first one, a complete fluke, where Saar bent it into the corner. It was clearly a cross. And then a penalty right at the end where Kepa, I think, you know, should have done better, really. He made it so clear what he was going to do. And Son was pretty smart with winning it. And it was a penalty and he put it away. And, you know, at the end of the game, I think you got two teams who Spurs will be relieved, I guess, you know, that they didn't lose at home. It felt like at any moment the atmosphere in the ground could have turned quite sour. There's obviously pressure on Postecoglou. The big game of the week is not this match against Bournemouth, because ultimately Tottenham's league campaign is very much over. Their big game of the week is against RZ Alkmaar on Thursday, where they've got to come from 1-0 down to kind of, you know, stay in the Europa League. So this felt like a dress rehearsal for that. It was a very wobbly, nervous, anxious dress rehearsal. And for Bournemouth, they should have won the game. Really should have won the game. And I think if they'd won it, they would be right in the mix, wouldn't they, for that kind of top four, top five. And as it is, I think they've still got some ground to make up.
Just very quickly, I've got a lot of love for Sarr with that cross, because I think he's the first person ever to score a goal that could have started a cross-shot debate and then immediately end the debate straight away with his celebration. He was like, no need for the debate, lads. That was, I'm not even going to pretend. Not even going to pretend. Just mentioning the comebacks, the afternoon's comeback was the 26th different time that Tottenham have scored, been two goals down in a Premier League match and come back to salvage at least a point, which I'm actually surprised by. Only Manchester United have done so on more occasions in the history of the competition. 30. Anyway, just a little stat for you there, because I was really surprised.
How many of them have been under Ange?
I don't know.
Probably a lot.
Yeah.
That feels like it would be a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, even under Conte, they had that period, remember, where they were terrible in the first half and then good in the second half all the time, and they came back a lot. So it's been going on a while.
The great entertainers, exactly. Mm. It works. And we're not having a quick moment for the Kirkes cross.
Oh,
it was a great goal.
Yeah, I mean, we can have more than a quick moment, can't we?
I could watch that 100 times,
beautiful.
I think.
Absolutely beautiful.
And that piece.
And I know, I'm sure you will agree with this as a former left-footed defender. There is something about it being left-footed as opposed to right-footed
that
makes it better, isn't it?
Definitely.
Or is that
maybe
just me?
Yeah.
Like,
no,
even Trent Alexander-Arnold, who puts in beautiful crosses, if you think about that same cross from the right side with someone who's right-footed, it wouldn't look as nice.
Yeah. I don't know why.
I mean, that's true kind of in all sports, isn't it? I mean, like with a tennis, you prefer a sort of left-handed serve.
Cricket, left-handed batsman, cover drive, looks nicer. Yeah. Don't know why.
It's rarer, isn't it?
Don't know why. See, all the big philosophical questions on the game podcast.
I loved when
today
he was bombing down, though, and you saw Iraola, like, I think it was Semenyo, or someone was going to make a run into the channel, and he was like, no. And he was pushing them all. He was saying, just get in the box. Yeah. He was like dissuading them from trying to link up or do anything silly, like, you know, any interplay or whatever. Just get the ball in the box. Everyone run for the box and he'll whip it in. And it, what a cross and finish. That's Bournemouth.
In a nutshell.
Get forward. The quickest route to goal, run straight.
I like the way Kirkes runs as well. He runs like a little kind of mischievous, like a little schoolboy running out of the playground at the end of the day. Like, come on, yeah, we're going. Down the flank again, off we go.
The offside goal was a thing of beauty as well. Mm. I think that was Tavernier, wasn't it? It's kind of little, down the left, just kind of little 1-2s through ball and the Clivert's
assist, drop of the shoulder and that assist, beautiful. We love Bournemouth, don't we?
We do love Bournemouth, but for all the accolades, and I think even if Liverpool win a treble this season, you could still argue Andoni Iraola should be in the conversation for coach of the season. I think, I mean, so many people are thinking, big clubs are thinking, we wouldn't mind him, but he has an Achilles heel, and his Achilles heel is thinking that Kepa, because he's the most expensive goalkeeper in the world, is the best goalkeeper in the world, and I'm not sure he makes the top 50 goalkeepers in the world, and he let them down.
He could be Chelsea's best goalkeeper though, still.
Possibly,
so.
But they're probably number 92 and 98.
True.
Should have suggested that at the top of the show, Alison. We could have just done the whole 50 goalkeepers in the world.
There have been a few teams. I thought that watching it too. There are a few teams you think this season, when they signed the goalkeepers, you thought, what are you doing? Like, this is a mistake. I thought when Ipswich signed Muric as well, this is a massive, massive, massive mistake. Did you not watch last season? Like, and it's cost them so many points. Chelsea or another, the start of the season, you think, this is not good enough. And when they sign Kepa, you know, there's a hope that they can, you know, rekindle some of the old magic, from his time in Spain. But
the stark fact is, he's not big enough to be a keeper, and he doesn't make up for it the way that Raya makes up for it by making lots of amazing decisions and reaction saves. He does lots of reckless stuff. I mean, giving away the penalty, it was, I can't think what he was doing. Mm. He had time to change his mind and realise, I'm going to take Son out here. Why would you carry on doing it?
Well, Son saw him coming and it was that thing where it was a penalty, but he drew the contact, didn't he? So just left his foot in, he could see Kepa coming and went down. I think Iraola said after the match that it was kind of a that Kepa gave him the chance to win the penalty, and I think that was about right.
The thing obviously you talk about first with Bournemouth is like the way they press, and I read there were 38 pressures that led to a turnover, which is the eighth highest of any game this season against Spurs. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But the other thing is how many brilliant technicians they have in the team. Like, so many people who are just Christie, again, who's someone who's really great at leading the press as well. But his little pass into Cliver, just kind of perfect weight, and Cliver just opened up and turned, and that had drawn out, I think it was Danso, and then he slipped in Evan Nielsen. It was just brilliant, perfectly executed stuff. And Evan Nielsen as well, obviously big misfortune having missed a lot of football with injury, but he's another one who's been a great signing. Yeah. I think he will be even better.
Do we think that the normal question in previous seasons, you know, before PSR and things, would be that this team would be completely ripped apart? Think of Southampton teams of old, where Liverpool just sign all their players. Thinking of Kerkez, I mean, he's got to be one of the top players in terms of being sought after.
Kerkez and Huijsen, I think there's even a bit of an acceptance at Bournemouth that
really
they're going to have to. They'll do well to keep them both.
Beyond the Cliverts and people like that, you think there's a world in which Iraola and this team could still be together?
I mean, Iraola is an interesting one because throughout his whole career, even when I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago when there was sort of talk about Iraola, and they were sort of saying, the thing is, you look at him throughout his career, he was at Athletic Bilbao for pretty much his whole career, had offers to go elsewhere but stayed there for sort of personal reasons, of course, but also because he felt a loyalty there and wanted to kind of develop his career there. He went to the States at the end of his career, even when he had offers from the Premier League, and he kind of kept to an agreement that he had to go to the States because he wanted to develop his coaching career there and learn English and learn about kind of the coaching methods of NFL and other things. Even at Rayo Vallecano, when he was being linked with Leeds, if you remember, there was a real kind of chase for him, and he said, "Nah, I'm going to stay until the end of my contract," which he did. He's a very sort of processed, methodical person. I don't think he's the kind of coach who will just leave on a whim, and I think he'll know what he's got here, that he's got a club where he is in charge, he can make the signings, he's now got the faith of the fans and the players. I hope that it doesn't come down to whether or not Bournemouth qualify for Europe, because right. I think if they do qualify for Europe, I suspect he'll be really tempted to do that and stay. If they don't, then I guess, you know, there may be bigger offers for him. But I think people who assume that Iraola will just jump ship to the first club that come from the Big Six or whatever in the Premier League.
Yeah, need to be persuaded about everything around the club and how well he'll be supported. I think, yeah. I agree with that. I don't think he'll just
jump. He's got a very clear idea about where his coaching path goes. You know, and if Spurs want him, I think they'll have to, I don't know, if Ange goes and Spurs wants him, it'll have to be a good pitch. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned about Spurs going. You coming back to Tottenham just to finish this segment. It is a huge week for Ange Postecoglou, isn't it? All the conversations about winning trophies and things, that terrible first leg against Alkmaar, do you think there's a potential, Tom, for if that second leg goes badly, that we could finally be asking the question, is Ange really in trouble now?
I think he'd be in trouble if they lose that game, because so much of Tottenham's season has been about when the injured players come back, and they're back. You know, they are back now. I mean, okay, you can say that Kulusevski's out, Van de Ven and Romero are kind of still getting some sharpness and fitness, but ultimately most teams across Europe have two or three injuries, and that's where Tottenham are at now. And I think that was why that game against Alkmaar last week, I think it really rattled the club, actually, because there was a sort of two or three, you know, wins in the Premier League. Even the performance against City was quite good, and everyone sort of felt like there was a sort of tide turning, momentum building. I think losing that game and the way they played, I think it was a really damaging defeat for Ange. And you could tell in the stadium yesterday that I don't think there's the same buy-in to Postecoglou as there was even two or three weeks ago. I think you can see in some of the players, not all, but I think in some of the players, there isn't quite the same all-out commitment to his way of playing. I think among the fans, you can tell that there's much more now a big chunk that are teetering on the edge of kind of faith in this project. I don't think it would take much now to kind of push it over the edge. And I'm sure the club are very reluctant to kind of go down the interim route, which they've done now, you know, two or three times in the last few years, and it hasn't worked well. But as we all know, sometimes events overtake, you know, and if they were to lose to AZ Alkmaar and then they play Fulham at the weekend, you know, maybe then they decide actually that they don't have a choice but to change. I think you look at the way Spurs played yesterday, it was chaotic, it was calamitous. You didn't see much of the kind of Ange way of playing. You didn't see players who were full of confidence. And to me, it was such a striking comparison with Bournemouth, where you look at a load of players who are playing two or three above their their ability. All across the team, you've got sort of 5 or 6 out of 10 players playing like 8 and 9s out of 10s, being linked with biggest clubs around Europe. There's evidence of good coaching, of players who are confident, who know their role, who know their position in the system. You look at Tottenham, you look down the team sheet and the squad, brilliant bench. They had Maddison, Udogie, Van der Ven all on the bench, really strong squad. And you're thinking they're underplaying, they're underperforming. This is not the team, you know, that should be playing at the level where they should be at, you know, and that comes down to the coach as well.
Interesting listening to you, because you've been one of the big kind of supporters, if maybe the wrong word, but has often batted back my suggestions on this podcast. Oh, the end is nigh. The end is nigh. This is the first time.
Well, it feels like faith's wavering, doesn't it? Yeah. Like right across the board. And I would agree, it does seem that way among the players as well. There's been a lot of damage done in the last, 4 or 5 months. Like belief among the players in what they're being told to do doesn't look like it's there, not like it was at the outset. So
it's the emperor's new clothes, isn't it? Everyone bought into this coach who had this strong philosophy, which was an entertaining one and slightly barking most of the time. But now that that's gone, you're left looking at him looking cross on the touchline. You think, well, what's he giving them? Like you say, he's making them less than the sum of their parts. They're not even entertaining anymore.
There we go. An entertaining game. And Ange Postecoglou's on his way out. There's loads to talk about. Here's what. I didn't think that this was coming.
I mean, I was going to say, let's see. I mean, it's a...
No, you can't go back on it now.
It's still possible that, you know, Tottenham have a great game. They go through on last 16. They're into the quarterfinals of the Europa League. They got the players back. There is still a narrow path to making something of this season. But I just think it's... It is a very narrow one.
Yeah, a huge, huge week. Another huge week for Ange Postecoglou, but a great performance, largely from Bournemouth, though we'll be disappointed not to win that game. Just wanted to finish with another lovely story coming out of Bournemouth. Alison Rudd, your interview with David Brooks from the weekend. Tell us a little bit about meeting him and his remarkable story.
It is a remarkable story, and I felt quite privileged to meet him and for him to talk so openly, and he was so relaxed about talking about it. Because if you think about it, if you've been through cancer, he was diagnosed 3.5 years ago with stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma, and he had to have intense chemotherapy and missed a year of football with poison, as he put it, with poison running through his body, and then he got injured. He got injured because you can imagine this, can't you? You get the all clear, a year of treatment, they say it's out, you're out of your system, and you think, oh, I want to be a footballer again. But he's nowhere near ready to be a footballer because he's been having chemotherapy and he's not been training and he's ballooned in weight because of the steroids he was on. But I want to be a professional footballer again. And so he tries too hard, and in a under-23 prep game, he gets a hamstring injury simply because he's putting too much weight on his system, because he's a little porky after all his treatment. And so he ends up missing 2 years of football. And you think, you know, in your mid-20s, that's so, so hard. And you've got to grapple with questions about, will I get through this? And, you know, your family are worried about you and so on. But he's come through it with a degree of, he's still really ambitious. And so when Areola came, he said, well, you don't seem to be using me too much. I want to go somewhere and prove, you know, almost prove post-cancer I can play 90 minutes and be a useful midfielder. And so he went to Southampton, where he had a great time. He had a fantastic time. And it was a bit unlucky that he got injured during the first half of their playoff final to win their place back in the Premier League. But he loved it there. And Bournemouth, obviously keeping track of him, and said, OK, we want you back. We want you to stay. And he's had to fight for his place again. And he's only really shone in games where Bournemouth have had their injury crisis. And he knows that. But when he's been asked to start, he's done well, really well. He was part of that 4-1 defeat of Newcastle and integral to that. We're in the midst of, they couldn't really choose anyone but him. But anyway, it's fine. But I think what I liked most about him was that, I mean, he's still only 27, but the way he spoke about perspective, and he now realises what a privilege it is to be a footballer, whereas I don't think you get that perspective before something bad happens to you.
Yeah.
And he spoke, he wasn't just saying the words, he meant it. You could tell he meant it. I felt he was telling me he's a different person now. Still ambitious, still wants to be a footballer, but it just means more, and he treats it as a proper gift in life to be able to be a Premier League footballer. And it was really lovely. But also, you know, there's those sliding doors moments that he was feeling really ill because he had cancer, but he didn't know he had cancer. So he wasn't training very well, and his stats from training were rubbish. And so Scott Parker, who was the manager then, said, why are you not running very fast? And he thought, oh, I must have fallen out of love with football. Not, oh, I might have cancer. Yeah. I must have fallen out of love with football. And his teammates are saying, then he got dropped, and his teammates are saying, well, you must be gutted to be dropped. You say, oh, not really, don't care. I think I've fallen out of love with football.
Wow.
And you think, oh, and then, so he's still feeling ill, can't sleep, very tired, losing weight, can't run very fast. He could very easily have said, oh, I'm not going to go on international duty because I'm not well. That's what people do, isn't it? Especially for Wales. They say, oh, I can't, I'm not well. And but he went. He went twice. He went once, hurt his knee, concentrated his knee. 2 weeks later, there was another international break. Even though he was feeling rubbish, he went back. And if he hadn't gone back, the doctor at Wales wouldn't have said, hang on a minute, all those symptoms sound like you should be in hospital tomorrow, mate. And he got his cancer diagnosis straight away. If he hadn't gone on international duty, which he had every right not to, and told people at Bournemouth, I think I've fallen out of love with football, that stage two would have become stage three. That stage three would then become stage four, and he might not be with us. So it's like, scary. You know, all these things that might or might not have happened. But he's fit and he's healthy, and he's really happy when he gets the minutes with the club.
Yeah. It's a lovely, lovely interview. If you search for Alisson's name and David Brooks, you'll find it on the Times website. Some much needed perspective in the mad world of football. Speaking of losing perspective, let's talk about a wall that was 11.2 yards away. Gregor, as a former defender, can I just say that when I saw this story coming out of the Manchester United-Arsenal draw, as a man who has been and sat next to Richard Clarke at many Football League games with my dad shouting, that's not 10 yards. I'm delighted that we finally got around to a wall being too far away.
Do you know what came into my head?
We've completed football, haven't we?
My head was thinking, there's going to be a technological advance that's going to solve this, and there's going to be lasers
wall
being
VAR.
Done to the pitch.
Wall VAR.
That was the wormhole I went down in my mind. I thought, what is this going to spawn?
It's great, isn't it? I'm being serious. I mean, I know, you know, Arsenal might be frustrated or whatever, but I was like, it's great, they're never far enough away. No, but that's also the training, isn't it, as a footballer? Everyone, you get marched out and the line goes down and you try and sneak a few yards forward. They're just not doing their jobs properly. If they'd done the little waddle forward, it would have been 10 yards and it would have all
been
fine.
What was funny as well is in the second half, clearly this information had been passed on, and the Man United players were like pointing to the mark on the ground when there was another free kick and like proper arguing for every little millimetre. So yeah, that is usually the way, but unusual way for an unusual controversy in that goal.
The normal thing is the player, you have the little shuffle, but then the real protest is when the player does his own march, isn't it? They sort of do their own march where they start counting and then telling the ref, and then the ref gives him a yellow card. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But none of this happened. You know,
there was no. That's
protest.
What I mean. We've never had this before. No. It was amazing. We've completed football lives. We don't need to carry on. But Bruno Fernandes scoring another free kick just a few weeks after I rifled off that stat about from Bill Edgar about 47 shots from free kicks without scoring. Then he got one against Everton and now another one. Carlos, who's a listener, got in touch on Twitter to say he was shocked that I didn't mention it the last time. So I thought I'd better mention it this time, otherwise Carlos will be back on again. Other than the wall controversy, this is, I mean, another example of Arsenal and their season, isn't it? You know, huge win in the week in the Champions League against, admittedly, a poor PSV side, Gregor, as we're discussing on Thursday. But going to Manchester United, a Manchester United who have been struggling all season, and they've drawn again against, you know, a team they should be beating, even without a striker. Do we think that's fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think PSV basically played the way that Arsenal would really want an opponent to play against them, and Man United played the way that I think increasingly opponents are realising you can play against Arsenal and have quite a lot of success. You know, we've seen against three or four, five, six teams this season who have played this, you know, low block, let Arsenal have the ball, they'll play, you know, what Johnny Northcroft said in his piece the weekend, you know, the kind of horseshoe football, goes down the left, comes back, recycles out to the right, comes back, and you know the opposition just sit in and say, well, you know, come and break us down. And Arsenal just, I know there's so much focus about the striker, and And that is clearly a real problem. You know, Mikel Merino is not a centre forward, and you can see that. But I also think that there's just a lack of creativity generally, you know, in this team. And you look at the way Odegaard's been playing in recent months, nowhere near his, you know, very brilliant best. Obviously, there are injuries with Saka and Martinelli, you know, and others who have been out for a long time. But they don't have that zip. I don't think they're playing quickly enough. You know, everything is too ponderous, everything is too safe, everything's too cautious. And I think Amorim, you know, robotic. Yeah, we talked a lot about Amorim, you know, having his own style and not adapting. But I actually think he was pragmatic in this match. He said, this is how we can play because we know this is how Arsenal struggle. They did it. They carried out the plan. And it was the same that we've seen so many times before with Arsenal, you know, unable to break a team down.
And United could have won were it not for David Raya with those saves at the end.
And Gabriel's block. Yeah. What a block that was. And Hoyland. I feel sorry for Hoyland, actually, because he finally
go.
He shinned it wide or whatever, then he saw the replay.
Cross into the six-yard area, I've made my run, here we go, 2-1. Oh, no, absolute nightmare. Alison, as chairwoman of the Martin Ødegaard fan club, how do you feel about Tom's evisceration of his performances of late?
No, I think I thought he had technically a very good game against...
Technically,
I see what you're getting at. No, he's still a joy to watch because of his control and vision and so on. But he's double acted with Saka, and that's missing. So one without the other isn't as great as the two of them together. And
even Ben White actually at right back, they have a nice little trio there. Don't they?
Yeah. So he's missing a wavelength player. Perhaps you can't. You know, I was once asked to win a football match on my own, and I know you can't.
What about Bruno Fernandes, though? Because he's literally keeping Manchester United afloat on his own.
Isn't it interesting, though? But I know so many United fans who can't stand him. It's really weird.
I'm going the other way on Bruno Fernandes now. I feel sorry for the guy. I mean, I know he moans, but so does everyone else. And I know he kind of has a go at the referee, but he's the captain. He cajoles them. I think there are fewer players this good in this bad a team at that size of a club that I can think of, really.
Oh, I'm pretty sure they'd be in the relegation zone if it wasn't for his existence. And yet, for some reason, some United fans don't appreciate him.
No, I agree. I know plenty of United fans who don't appreciate him. It's very odd.
I mean, it was extraordinary that they went in at 1-0 ahead at half-time. They were woeful. Like, I totally take what Tom was saying and what Amorim said about, you know, we aspire to do more than this. But, like, when's that going to happen? How many transfer windows? How many players do you need to sign before you can start to like play any sort of sign of any sort of adventurous football or possession-based football? They did frustrate Arsenal, and they did kind of, you know, they were just really compact. They defended the box. So it was like watching Arsenal in late era Wenger, where they sort of just so much tippy-tappy football around the box, but nothing, none of the sort of, as Tom's saying, speed and like a little bit of guile where there's little gives and goes or a little back heel or something that just opens up a pocket of space. None of that at all. So Man United were totally within the rights to play like that, but you can see why he's almost running this campaign to say, look guys, just to be clear, this is not how it's always going to be. He has to you can see why he's saying this, because it's bad.
Yeah, but that's also maybe also part of a lot of previous Manchester United managers' downfall, is where they maybe got a decent tactic that worked of like smash and grab, sit in and then break, but then couldn't break down teams who sat in against them. And he's going, no, don't worry, this is my only plan.
It's jarring, though. You watch them for the whole first half, just sitting off and letting the opposition have the ball at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
And offering nothing, just really playing long balls to like a pretty dejected looking Xerxes. And yeah, as I say, they went in 1-0, and you're like, how the hell did that happen? And they improved in the second half, and it did become a bit wilder as Arsenal tried to do a bit more to get back in the game, and they could have won it. But that first half, I just thought, what are we watching here?
But if they'd taken Arsenal on at their own game, they would have lost the game, wouldn't they?
I agree.
That's the conundrum, isn't it?
I agree. I see there's complete logic in it, but it's still jarring.
Both things can be true?
Both things can be true.
There it is. Ding! The Gregor Robson catchphrase to end the first half.
But it just is interesting that he feels the need to run this little sort of campaign now.
Yeah.
Saying, guys, it's not always going to be like this.
Yeah.
I aspire to more than this.
Let's not slag off Ruben Amorim, the back page quotes machine that he is. As we were saying, not a great game, and kind of does raise the prospect of the question, what is the greatest game that you could have in the prime time 4 p.m. Sunday slot, which we are going to come to in part two, so you've got some time to think about it, ladies and gents. But it means we're going to take a break, and I'm going to ask the quiz question. Who am I talking about when I say a former footballer who holds the joint record for having been relegated from the Premier League with five teams and was a defender for Crystal Palace, Wimbledon, Ipswich, Charlton and Portsmouth? Find out after the break.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Quince believes that quality products shouldn't be a luxury, whether it's a breathable 100% European linen shirt or effortless stretch cotton pants. All of their high-end, top-quality pieces are about half the cost of similar brands. Yes, really. By working directly with top artisans and cutting out the middlemen, Quince gives you luxury pieces without the markup. Get the high-end goods you deserve at quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You know what's wild? Most people are still overpaying for car insurance just because it's a pain to switch. That's why there's Jerry. Jerry's the only app that compares rates from over 50 insurers in minutes and helps you switch fast with no spam calls or hidden fees. Drivers who save with Jerry could save over $1,300 a year. Before you renew your car insurance policy, do yourself a favor. Download the Jerry app or head to jerry.ai/ACAST.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I've got Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Tom Allnut with me. They might know loads and loads about football, but when it comes to the quiz question, they were useless this week. Thank God we had producer Neil sat in the corner who chimed in with the answer, which was Herman Hreiðarsson. Herman Hreiðarsson. And I bet you also don't know who he shares the record with from five relegations. Nathan Blake. There you go. Nathan Blake. There you go, listeners. There's your pub quiz question for this week to impress
your
mates.
Going up a notch in level of difficulty there, Tom. Yeah, which I'm just, okay with.
I just thought I'd keep you on your toes. You know, I was just.
I don't think we can cope with the answer isn't Marquise.
For 3 weeks in a row, yeah.
I know. You bring that up again, for God's sake. And maybe I'll try and get Mark Hughes to come on at the end of the season to deliver the question. See if I can get him to do a voice note. Might depend on how he's getting on with Carlisle. Anyway, let's get back to the Premier League and start talking about those thrilling, engrossing 1-0 wins at the weekend. And Gregor Robertson, you were at the City Ground to watch Nottingham Forest beat Manchester City. Prove all those doubters, some of those listeners who've been getting in touch with me to tell you, to give you pelters, to say, no, Gregor's wrong. Forest are going to dip. They're going to dip. They're back. Back to their 1-0 winning ways.
Yeah, it was a very Forest performance. They just don't press. They don't, until the team sort of enter your third even sometimes.
Danger zone.
Certainly your half. They just don't engage. And City, for large swathes of the first half, were just passing the ball around at the back. And everyone was like, are you going to do something? You're like, this is boring everyone to tears. Forest were happy with it. And again, absolute logic in it. And it worked. And this is Forest's kind of, this is Forest's way. And they're always a threat on the break. But, and then sort of as the second half developed, Forest began to build some momentum. And they looked by far the more dangerous and threatening side. And Hudson-Odoi came up with the decisive moment. Had another great kind of, it's almost a Hudson-Odoi trademark now, you know, when he comes in from the left, you know, skips past inside a few defenders and then aims one for the far corner, and Ederson made a brilliant save to tip it onto the post. And then he wasn't quite so good with Hudson-Odoi's finish, letting one in at his near post. As I say, like, this wasn't a brilliant game. It wasn't hugely entertaining until like the last half an hour when Forest took the lead, and the atmosphere was incredible in the last 20 minutes, absolutely bouncing. And it was seismic. You know, this is a huge, huge win for Forest, yeah, to open up the gap. This is the kind of the day that you felt they're probably going to make the Champions League. Like, well, there's 10 games to go. They've got quite a favourable run in. They've got Ipswich next. I think they're going to do it. I think that was the feeling in the stadium, and the noise and the colour and the sound and everything just reflected that. It was brilliant. But it was just a really effective win. It wasn't like it wasn't a basketball game by any means. It was
listening to you talk there about the way Forest won't engage until they're ready to. Do you think there's? I mean, I think they really reflect the personality of their manager. If you went for a dinner party, if you went to a dinner party with Nuno, he wouldn't do chit chat. I mean,
have you seen his program notes? They're hilarious. There's like maybe three sentences. It's just
I guess you're right.
It's like, welcome to the opposition. Thanks for your support. You know, you Reds. It's like, honestly, short. It's like, I was sitting beside Johnny and we were just laughing about it.
You wouldn't invite him to a dinner party where you needed people who were chatting. You wouldn't. I mean, his post-match is often very monosyllabic and he doesn't do that charm offensive thing at all.
No.
But
he can be goody when he warms up.
Exactly. So the team reflects him.
No, again, this is no criticism at all of Forest. They've been magnificent and they're so well organised and they close space, and City couldn't really find a couple of half opens when the little cutbacks that they skied over the bar and stuff. The criticism is of City. Like, they just had no wit.
Just before we get to City, though, I'm just interested listening to you talk about that and thinking about Champions League and kind of linked to Bournemouth as well. Can they do it again? If I know I'm doing the classic podcast host thing of talking about things in the future. Let's just enjoy now. We're going to get Champions League. But it does kind of beg the question. You're talking there about City. Well, we know what Forest are going to do. Can they do it? Can they keep this going? Or it's just, I'm wondering about the one season wonder type effect. How do you take what they've got, which is brilliant, and adapt it for next season when, if they're going to have Europe, which almost certainly looks like they will in some form, and teams know exactly what you're going to do. Can you just keep doing it?
I mean,
you can.
That's a big question, and it's one that probably we can leave till they've actually done
it.
No,
answer it.
I mean, yeah, look, it's the same for any of these teams, like Bournemouth or anyone who, if they make Europe, the pressures on the squad and on the team and the workload and everything just is transformative. It makes everything so much harder. But one thing you've got to say is the way Forest play is, a lot of it is conserving energy and you know, moments where they kind of burst forward and are a real threat. So that'll always be the case. But I don't know. That's a hard question to answer because, as I say, they just don't play the other team's game. Yeah. They just, you know, City probe and they knock it into Nico in the middle and try and find. They could not find anyone in those little pockets of space centrally. That De Bruyne in his prime have been so dangerous in, or Foden can be. They just could not find any space in there at all. So they kept funneling wide to Doku or out to Savinho. Aina's one of the best 1v1 defenders in the league. I would put Tyrant Mitchell number one and Aina a close second. I think for that skill of just a 1v1 duel against a winger, they're absolutely outstanding, and Doku didn't get a sniff. If he went past them maybe once in the game, there wasn't a final ball. And Nico Williams was almost as good on the other side against Savinho. So they just backed themselves to do that. They funneled the ball wide and gave them no joy whatsoever centrally. So, what's the answer to that? City couldn't find one.
Yeah, maybe they can keep going. Tom?
I don't know. I think it's difficult. I mean, I just think, if you look at history, like when you have these teams, these breakout teams, and I don't think there are going to be many better seasons in the Premier League than Forest. I mean, you know, you look back and you put this right up there with, okay, Leicester winning the league, you know, Everton, I guess, you know, getting the top four once or twice a day, you know, but I mean, it's hard to remember a season as good as this from Forest. The problem they'll have, I think, is one, keeping the players, because there will probably be two or three players who will be wanted by bigger inverted commas clubs. And I think the other thing is, teams start to work you out. That is the thing. I agree that we've seen Forest so many times play against opponents this season where they just don't know what to do against them because they don't want the ball, they don't want to play the game, and it works. I just wonder next season. I think other teams start finding solutions. And the thing that they'll have to do is, if they do qualify for the Champions League, is buy really well to use that money and to use the kudos to kind of update the squad again. The problem you have, I think, is that clubs who want to sign those, you know, better quality players
they can pay bigger wages because they know we're going to be in the Champions League for two or three years in a row. Whereas Forest, they can't say that. Mm. Financially, they can't say we're going to be in the Champions League two or three years, so therefore we can spend 60 million, 70 million. We can pay that kind of wages to get that type of player. So they're still going to be shopping in a market which is more of a mid-table kind of market, and they have to find more of these bargains, which they've already done. So I think it's hard. I think it's hard to repeat.
I mean, they should be shopping in that market. I think Marinakis will try and shop in the best market. Look, they tried to sign Cunha in January.
Yeah.
I think he will push it to the very outer limits of spending rules again, and possibly possibly slightly too far again. They will. The ambition is there. Look, they've just brought in Edu from Arsenal to oversee the whole kind of the whole football group.
But it's hard to persuade those players, right? I mean, Cunha didn't go, and it's hard to persuade those players to join the Forest thing and to say to them, we're going to get there again and finish second and keep going. You know, that's a hard sell.
And there's been not many people been more critical of Forest, like, madness since they were promoted and the scattergun approach and how many players they signed. But they've changed it. They have. I think Ross Wilson deserves a lot of credit for, like, calming everyone around him down and saying, like, we need to, and possibly the points deduction also was like brought them back down to earth a little bit. We can't go mad here. But the three players who could well be selected by Thomas Tuchel have all been like really smart for different reasons and very cost effective signings. Gibbs White, his fee could rise to 42.5 million. When he was signed, when he just won promotion, everyone was like, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, you remember, the Forest fans thought that. He didn't get off to a great start, and there was a bit of stick in the, you know, he was getting a bit of stick in the crowd. He's one of the most exciting players in the league now. Elliot Anderson was, like, really opportunistic, very modern, like, profit and sustainability regulations at Newcastle.
Yeah,
they had to sell him.
Didn't want to sell him, did they? No.
Forest were first. They did it quickly. They got him. 35 million. I was sitting beside Johnny and we were saying, who's playing alongside Declan Rice for England in the next two games?
Yeah.
And that's not an easy question to answer. And you look at Elliot Anderson and he's like so multi-talented. He can play number 10, he can play 6, he can play 8, he can even play off the left. He's not going to for England, but I think he should be in that conversation, definitely. And then there's Hudson-Odoi. He was £3 million, and as I wrote about in the game today, it's not that long ago he was, the Bayern bid 70 million for him. Yeah. And like a lot happened after that. But there's a real player there. And again, they were the ones, I think Fulham were trying to sign him, and they probably blew them out of the water with money because Marinakis is ambitious. But he's someone as well who's getting the game time and is showing. He just turned 24 in November.
Yeah.
He's still a lot of football in him. So these guys could be England internationals. And as I say, I've been very critical of them, but they deserve credit now because there are more of these success stories. Aina was a free transfer. Maria was 8 million.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of success stories now, so if they can keep
Milinkovic
keep,
as well, I think everyone would have one of
10 million. You can keep boxing clever like that.
In terms of spreading their net and trying to attract players, Tom, I mean, they have the advantage of having a history and a pedigree and being a big club once upon a time. It's not like if you were, say, Bournemouth and Forest both qualify for the Champions League, which is not impossible. If you were casting your net for players to come and you were weighing it up as a young player, Forest have the better PowerPoint presentation when it comes to what sort of club they are, and they're having won the biggest trophies in Europe and having an amazing stadium.
They have the history and the pedigree and the size, not quite as big a club as Villa, but they have that to call upon and say, we're trying to bring this club back to that. So yeah, look, it's always hard. We know this. There's been countless examples of teams who are trying to break into that top. Villa are one of them. Newcastle, like, with bigger resources, it's hard to sustain it. So who knows what the future holds, but they're enjoying the ride.
Absolutely. Lots of positives for Nottingham Forest. And as you mentioned, Gregor, Thomas Tuchel naming his first England squad at the end of this week. So we'll see if the likes of Colin Hudson-Odoi and Elliot Anderson can make it. Now, I think, guys, this might be the ultimate insult to Manchester City's season, that segment, because they lost a game against Nottingham Forest. Man City, the Man City, lost to Nottingham Forest, and we barely even want to talk about them. Who cares? Boring.
Like,
just all talk about Nottingham Forest. Normally, that segment would go, oh my God, Man City have lost, and we'd do 10 minutes about Man City, and then I would go, quick, we have to mention Nottingham Forest. They were really good, weren't they, Gregor? And we've done it the other way around. The ultimate insult to Pep Guardiola. But Gregor, you wanted to mention Erling Haaland, because you said earlier, before we started recording this show, that you were sat there thinking, I don't know what he's doing. He got the Gregor Robertson exhale treatment.
No, obviously Tony's written about him Tony Cass has written about him in the game today and saying that he's basically redundant. And there were moments in the second half of this game. There was one moment where I actually leaned back and went, "Oh, Erling," and I sort of caught myself. Hang on, what are you doing? But you just think,
is this in line with your return to action that you're thinking I could die?
No. But you just think, you just watch the game going on around them and think, like, what? You know, there's just so many bodies around them. As I say, Forrest just packed the centre of the pitch around the box, and like it doesn't even look like there's any point in making a run for, like, in case a cross comes in the box. I agree with Cass, and it's been a debate for a long time. It's been rolling, and you think, he can't be happy. He can't be. He just can't be. I know if he's scoring goals and he's contributing and the team's successful, that's going to ease a lot of those kind of those worries or whatever about your involvement in the game. But he can't be happy. He cannot be happy with that level of involvement, and the goals aren't really flowing, and City aren't successful. Like, that can't go on. And we're not expected to go on forever, but.
Well, his forever. It's a 9-year contract, for goodness sake.
Well, his position in Manchester City's team is just really peculiar to watch. It is.
Do you think Pep Guardiola can work out the solution to this conundrum, Tom? His own conundrum?
Haaland specifically.
And Haaland and City, and build this bright new future? Because as Johnny Northcroft said a few weeks ago, I think was very interesting, talking about it's Haaland's team now once you give him a 9-year contract. Yeah. That's the theory, that it's Haaland's team going forward.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with Haaland is that you kind of look at him pre-City, and the goals he scored were not like the goals he's trying to score now, right, at the moment. Because, you know, he used to love sort of space to run into and explosive, exactly, whereas now he's kind of playing as a sort of penalty box predator, you know, looking for scraps, and I'm not really sure that is his game. I mean, what Pep has done over his career is he's always adapted, you know, and he's been able to tweak his own sort of philosophy and way of playing to the opponents around him. I think he's going to have to do that again, you know, because I think he will probably recognise that his style of football that has not, you know, been so successful over the last few years, at the moment, isn't working as well as it used to, you know, against these teams who are much quicker, much better in transitions, and who soak up this pressure. And it's kind of what Arteta is finding as well, you know, that the robotic football, I think, has almost been found out, you know. And what Guardiola has done before is he is not too proud to say, okay, we have to evolve, we have to move on, we have to bring in players who can do something different. I would imagine that City will, you know, go big in the summer, and they'll bring in players who can do something like that next season. So I still think City will come back strong, to be honest, next year, because I think they'll have a better squad, they'll have a bigger squad as well. I think he's recognised, Guardiola, who's always liked a small, tight-knit group, I think he realises that in the current climate you need a bigger squad as well, much more options to kind of deal with all the competitions. If he's got the energy and he's got the impetus to go again, which I'm really surprised he does, to be honest, then I don't think we can write City off next season.
No, we won't write him off just yet. But it is interesting that Erling Haaland has even got the Gregor Robertson treatment of, Erling, what can you do? The ultimate criticism for
Erling.
That's
more feeling sorry for him, actually.
You feel sorry for him?
It's so strange when he's got a 10-year contract on half a million a week or whatever.
Yeah. I changed my mind, Alison. That's the biggest insult to Manchester City this season. Let's go and look at another 1-0 game. Brentford against Aston Villa. A win for Villa, which means they end their 7-game winless run in the Premier League after playing in Europe in the midweek. So far this season, they've drawn 3 and lost 4 after playing in Europe. Back to winning ways. Back to back winning ways, Alison. What did you make of this game? Another thriller?
It wasn't the second half was quite good fun, actually. It wasn't too bad.
gushing
going over the top there slightly. It was a slightly odd game given that stat. I would have expected Brentford to really harry and go at Villa, because the stats show they're always knackered after Europe, aren't they? And we've been talking a lot about how clubs might fare when they're juggling Europe when they're not used to, and keeping tabs in the Premier League, and Villa have shown they're not quite at it. It is a juggling act. They're doing okay. They're probably doing slightly better than a lot of people thought, but it's clearly taking a lot out of them. But if you know that, I'd have thought Brentford might have tried to expose that, capitalise on that. And they were quite passive. They defended quite well, but defended very well, actually, to start with. But they were quite passive. And Brentford only woke up when Villa were denied a second goal quite soon after Watkins had given them the lead. And that reprieve suddenly changed everything. And it was all Brentford, virtually, apart from the odd break from Villa. And Brentford looked like the team I have come to love. They were good fun, and they hit the post and came close and would have deserved a draw.
Should have had a penalty or penalties?
And that's the thing. They should have had two penalties, I think. I've seen quite a lot of Thomas Frank. I have never seen him look so A, ill, and B, angry. I mean, he was fuming, monosyllabic and cross, and just not himself at all.
The first one was strange, wasn't it?
Because he was given, player. He asked why there was no penalty given against Disasi, who literally just
he took out Cash. Took out Shada.
Like dominoes.
He kept him through his own player.
It was a very poor challenge, and also, yeah, slightly odd, because there was another another Villa player in the middle of it, sandwiched. And the VAR review came back, because they give you a reason, and the VAR review said, oh, it wasn't a penalty because Cash had managed to head the ball. Which, I mean, I've done refereeing. That's not a thing. So what? He still took him out. Yes. I don't get it at all. I initially assumed the ball must have gone out of play by the time everyone was clattered over, but that's replay showed that wasn't the case. So it's like VAR official making up rules that don't exist. So that was a clear penalty Brentford denied. And given how good Mbeumo is at taking penalties, you knew we would have scored. And then Disasi again was involved, shoving over Sharda again. And Frank said maybe it was 50-50. It was probably a penalty. But in this season where you don't overturn things, it wasn't so obviously a gaffe to get overturned. So I can see why he was cross. But the fun thing from Villa's point of view, I mean, Emery always looks absolutely exhausted after every game. This season is taking it out of him. Listening to him speak, it was as if he had kicked every ball, and it was quite the trial for him, and he was so relieved they'd finally managed to break that run of not being able to win after playing in Europe, and he felt it was incredibly important. But a lot of the they clearly a team that needs energising after they've played in the Champions League, and Axel Disasi gave them that energy. But he's a very strange player, I think, because he had a lot of calamitous performances for Chelsea. Although I think he had the possibility of becoming a fan favourite. He's one of those players that does an amazing thing and then a gaffe. You know, it's like, which one are you going to get?
Don't we in England? We love that.
Gregor would have been cringing, because he was celebrating every tackle like he just won the cup final.
Do you remember when he celebrated a tackle, I think against Man United when he was at Chelsea, but he gave the ball away directly to create the chance that he saved?
Yeah.
That was the peak. Yeah, that was too much.
An entertainer.
I'm finished with the Sassy after that.
And he could, well, I get your point, and he could have given away, and maybe should have given, I mean, you know, he could have given away two penalties, so, you know. But on the other hand, he did give the Villa team this sense of personality and energy, and he's really eye-catching. And I don't even know where his best position is, because I think at fullback he does look exposed a lot. But the fact that he didn't seem to care, this wasn't his best position, and he really went for it. I mean, maybe overall when he calms down, he will be a great defender. Maybe he will. Mm. But I think for all his mistakes, I think he lent Villa a much needed sense of oomph in what was becoming a debilitating pattern for them.
Yeah, just thinking about Villa, and I was being mischievous about Nottingham Forest and Bournemouth, so I might as well do the same about Villa. And thinking about the end of the season, Gregor, last Thursday we were saying, oh, great first leg win against Bruges, what a fantastic achievement it would be if they can get into the Champions League quarterfinals. But then there's that sense of, well, do we think they're going to win the Champions League? Probably not. So you then look at the league table with them having played 29 games, which is two more than Newcastle, who have played tonight, of course, but one more than everyone else. Brighton have got themselves back into the conversation as well. are you starting to think that with these ambitions to sign people like Rashford and Asensio and things, that Villa, if they finish, I don't know, eighth, but go out of the Champions League, that's actually not a great season? Even if they Champions League quarterfinal is fantastic, you know.
It comes back to the reality that we were talking about, of how hard it is to when you make this step up. It was different when they were playing in the Conference League because they just changed their whole 11 for Thursday night football. It's different, you know, when you've got the best teams in Europe coming that you're facing on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and you've got to play your best team, and then you've got to recover and play in the Premier League. Newcastle found the same issue.
So no, I wouldn't. If they get through against Bruges, they go, right, quarterfinals, that's enough now, lads. Let's get back to the league.
It'd be ridiculous, Tom.
You get back to the league because we need to finish fifth because we need Champions League again.
Yeah, but they're in the Champions League.
Yeah, but they won't be next season unless they win
it. But they're in it now.
Yeah.
I never understand this thing.
Teams are obsessed with
getting in the Champions League, and even when they're in the Champions League, and they just say, actually, let's be in the Champions League again next season.
What's the point in trying to be obsessed to get in it if you're not going to do something when you're in it? Also, there's the idea that you can, like, you know, focus on one thing and not the other is ludicrous. It never happens unless it's a lesser competition, and the Champions League is not that. So it may not last long, the juggling act. It might be over soon, whether they like it or not. And if they finish eighth, it's still not a disastrous season. It's not. I mean, if they end up back in the Conference League, it would be a bit of a blow to their pride. But it's not going to be a straight trajectory. It's the same in Newcastle. And even, it might not be an upward trajectory at all. Well, it's
easily,
so hard.
They could easily win the FA Cup. I mean, they've got Preston next. I mean, it could be an amazing season.
All things can be true, Greg. All things can be true.
I do think that clubs in general probably have to kind of get used to this new reality where actually the days of the kind of set and forget Big Four, even Big Six, are gone, you know? And we had that thing for a while where it was sort of the top three was set and then there was a challenge for fourth or whatever. But actually, you know, I think clubs like Newcastle and Villa and Spurs, Chelsea for now,
Brighton, Bournemouth, there's loads of them.
Yeah, but even the ones who get in almost have to just square with the fact that maybe next season they won't get in. They're not going to get in every year because there is going to be a bit of a yo-yo between that set, you know, and that financially, from a point of view of squad planning, everyone probably has to get on board with the fact that when you're in the Champions League, you have to kind of take advantage of it, you know, because you might not be in it for another couple of years because the way the calendar is now, it takes its toll on you and therefore your chances of finishing in the top four or five are massively reduced when you're in it. So take advantage of it. It's the same in the Europa League. When you're in that competition, go for it because, you know, the Premier League now is that there are no guarantees, are there, in terms of the top six and seven? And I think all these teams probably have to come to terms with the idea that, you know, that area between third and eighth is now, you can't guarantee anything financially or psychologically, you know, and you have to take advantage when you're in those competitions. Otherwise, you know, you might not be back for a while.
There's obviously like a huge conversation about the, you know, the spending rules and whether that's kind of shackling the teams who are really of great ambitions to break into that, you know, break the hegemony. But I've said it before, the teams, it also means that teams can't buy your best players off you.
Yeah.
None of these teams are being pilfered. They can't, you know, City can't go out and buy all the best players in the Premier League. They can't afford to do it. No one can. So, and actually, no other team in Europe can. So you can still, you know, it might take longer, but you can build a squad. And, you know, if you plan it well, you can over time do it, I think.
Yeah, it's perfectly teed us up for the rest of the season, guys. Where, as you say, Tom, getting excited about that battle between third to eighth, which is what we're really having to get our teeth into as Liverpool walk away with the title. Guys, I just wanted to finish with a topic, because the theme of this show has been that we weren't particularly entertained by the football on offer this weekend, particularly around the Manchester United Arsenal being the big prime time 4 p.m. Sunday game. Everyone sits down, maybe got a little glass of wine, maybe a roast dinner, have a lovely time, watch some football, be entertained at the end of the weekend, and we were not. So I wanted to ask, what would your ideal matchup be? Prime time. Greg is pulling a face that says, do not come to me first.
Correct.
I cannot for the life of me think of one. And the reason for asking this off the back of the Villa question was that I think Villa of late could be one of the two teams with particularly their new attacking talents. But maybe, Alison, you would say after Saturday's game, definitely not. Not if they've had a Champions League game in the week. Would you agree?
They're not going to be primetime fodder.
No.
I just don't think Villa are entertaining enough. My ideal primetime fodder
would be Liverpool against Liverpool.
I'm a sucker for teams that overachieve and have good coaching. So I and I'm into Schadenfreude as well. So prime 4 p.m. fodder is someone like Brighton beating Man United, or Bournemouth beating Man United, or
Fulham
beating Man United.
But I
get a lot of entertainment value out of watching a big club.
It feels like a very personal choice.
Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. That wasn't quite what I was asking. That's a different kind of entertainment, I would say.
No, I think a lot of people would find that entertaining.
Yes, I'm sure. I think they probably do. Tom,
I think you have to have Tottenham.
That's what I mean. Tottenham Bournemouth could easily be the game, couldn't it?
Because Spurs, you know,
it's calamity is entertaining.
But it always sets up a good game.
Depends if you like slapstick.
Yeah.
Mm. If you like torture, then you're Alisson Rooney. You like kind of go for the big team being on the way down.
Like sadism.
Yeah. If you like slapstick, you got to go Ange, haven't you?
And then I think you'd have them away from home, maybe a team like Fulham. You know, like a sort of like a...
I've got that game coming up.
I thought Fulham, but I just don't know whether they're quite...
They're quite inconsistent. You don't know what you're going to get.
But that's what we want, isn't it? We want unpredictability.
We want
clash
entertainment,
of styles.
Tom. Entertainment.
I think there are goals in that game.
Newcastle on
there.
Yeah.
You've also got to think about the matchup.
Come on then, I've given you an extra 2 minutes.
I think Bournemouth are one of the teams. I'm just not entirely sure I want them to play. I would have said Forest, but I think there's too much like...
No, you can't have... The way you sold Forest earlier, I'm sorry, you can't be putting Forest at
And they just smashed them 5-0, didn't they? So
Forest are prime lunchtime on a Saturday.
I think Bournemouth-Liverpool. Because I think...
Ooh, Liverpool. You know what that is? You know what that is? That is old Liverpool versus new Liverpool.
Oh my God, she's done it. How did she manage to do that?
But it is, isn't it?
Well,
it's a bit like watching Klopp.
Oh, so how have you managed to bring Klopp into this?
Yeah.
But it is true.
It's like Liverpool aren't going to change the way they play, and Bournemouth are going to... They don't care who they're playing against. I think that's an entertaining game. It has been an entertaining game, and Liverpool come out on top, but... I think that's probably my pick.
There you go. You got there in the end, despite grimacing all the way through that. We got some suggestions.
Well, Fulham play Spurs on Sunday, right? Yeah. So if there's more than 5 goals, then I think I win the argument.
And are you going to that game, Alison?
And I'm going to that game.
Great.
So Thank you for that, Tom.
Come back 1 week from today where Alison Rudd will have seen officially the most entertaining game in the Premier League. We'll see you then. Alison Rudd, Tom Allnuts and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me on today's very entertaining game podcast. Thank you too for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. As I say, we'll be back on Thursday, and me and Gregor have got an EFL show this week as well. We'll see you then.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ready to level up your everyday? Quince makes premium essentials without the premium price tag. From quality clothing and stylish accessories to travel staples and high-end home goods, Quince has it all. And by partnering directly with top artisans and ethical factories, Quince delivers high quality at half the cost of similar brands. Shop elevated essentials without the markup at Quince. Go to quince.com/levelup for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/levelup.